What's going on? What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi right here in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We'd love to have you on board. This is Upfront on the Voice of America.
Upfront is a show that explores issues
that affect your daily lives. Don't move that dial. Get your snacks, get your cup of tea or your cup of coffee. Put your feet up. This is Upfront. cheers. Yaga.
Welcome to Upfront on the Voice of America. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. Now, figures show that over 1 billion of the world population are youth. Many fall between the ages of 16 to 35. And in Africa, known as the youngest of the continents, over half of the population are under the age of 25. And scientists say that this is the largest number of youth ever to have inhabited the world. It also means that at any single time or point in any part of the world, youth are most likely to occupy more physical space than any other demographic. That means that land issues are as critical to youth as they are to other demographics. Because you see, land is not just a source of sustenance for the young farmer in a village or a young office worker in the city trying to make ends meet. It is in many ways a source of identity and cultural expression. And as we will find out later on in the show, there's also a gender dimension to land and its ownership. In many societies, girls do not have equal rights and access to land as boys do. But in general, issues around land rights and policies have wider implications, including the common issue of rural-urban migration. See, young people moving from rural areas to urban cities in search of employment. Rural-urban migration is one of the issues, but there are other issues like land disputes that are also a source of conflict and insecurity, and many others that we'll look at later on in the show. And the reason why land is an issue to the young people on the continent is that it has to do with the fact that very often youth are left out of any decisions or policies governing land use and ownership. So on the show today, we want to look at how governments can guarantee equitable access and sustainable utilization of land where everybody feels like they have a sense of ownership and make decisions about how land in their societies, in their communities, in their countries is acquired and governed. This is Upfront on the Voice of America.
My name is Akim Mugisa. I'm a Ugandan. I stay in Juba, South Sudan. I'd love to have a better land policy, because I know when there's a better policy, I'd be able to use my land to the best, to see that I maximize productivity of the land, maybe farming, maybe renting it out to generate an income from that. And the ways of acquiring land, I can acquire it from my grandparents, because they have a responsibility of giving us a portion of land when we reach a responsible age of around 18 years. As well, I can, if I'm working hard, maybe I generate my own income.
My name is Esther Mwambi. As a woman, our father does not consider girls in terms of giving land. He only gives to boys.
I got one through my parents, where we shared. We are five in family. So the small we had, we shared.
Yes, I think we need a better land policy, one which regulates that farmland should remain farmland. And
yeah, we need a better land policy, because there have been a lot of conflicts in terms of land. People are quarreling for that. So I think as a country of Malawi, there has to be a specific policy for that.
You've just joined us, welcome to it, and thank you for being with us today. Like we do each Wednesday, you know how we do. This is Upfront. I'm Nadia Sami, coming to you from Cape Town, South Africa, and Jackson Vunganyi is doing his thing in Washington, D.C.
When you talk to young people on the streets of South Africa about land ownership, the common concern is, where do I get the capital to buy land? So where do I get the money for a deposit? In many cases, when you want to buy land, you're a first-time land you're a first-time homeowner, you're aiming to be a first-time homeowner, you'll be required to put down a deposit, and that kind of capital a lot of young South Africans don't have. And it's a complete setback, because it means people spend many years of their lives paying rent when they could be paying a bond.
Of course, fetch a course, such a good devil force. Today, that took away boss, took a jerk of loss. Feverlass, Ayabas, Mizuki Chikakiras. Yo, this is your boy Babaluku. You're listening up front with my boy Jackson. I'm an Empress Nadia on the Voice of America. We're doing it for the people.
Welcome to Upfront on the Voice of America. If you're just joining us, we are looking at issues relating to land policy and access in Africa as relates to youth. And as we said earlier, Africa has the youngest population of all the continents. And with a population of over 1 billion inhabitants, it makes land a critical resource. The livelihood and income of the majority on the continent is either from farming, from livestock production, many other activities that require heavy land use. But even with this kind of heavy dependence on land, many governments on the continent still struggle with land policy issues and land tenure systems. And we know it can sound a little boring to young people, but let's talk to somebody who will kind of dissect some of these issues for us and make it interesting. And for something that we depend on every day, why is there very little interest from young people on land? Also, why is there such complexity around it? Carol Baudreau is a land tenure and resource rights practice expert at the Cloudburst Group here in Washington, D.C. She says that understanding the land tenure systems is not easy, even for experts.
It's a complicated set of systems. Around Africa, you have this wonderful mosaic of land tenure arrangements. In some places, you have private land holdings. In a lot of parts of the continent, you have communal land holdings. You have pastoralists, you have forest dwellers, you have farmers, you have all of these systems, some of which have been evolving literally for millennia. You also have systems that were introduced by colonial governments. Many of those systems are still in place. So you have this very complicated, very rich environment. And because it's complicated and because it's a very rich environment, it's also a confused environment in some places. So you have systems, environments where there are customary systems that sort of overlap with statutory systems. And sometimes it's not entirely clear which rules and which institutions are in charge of governing the land in a particular place.
Are there any international laws that govern local or national land tenure systems as we know of them?
Yeah, there are laws, especially for women, the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination for Women, the CEDAW Convention, is international law, and it governs how women are supposed to hold rights to land and other property. Most African countries have acceded to the CEDAW Convention, and so they are supposed to, in their national law, follow the principles of that international law. There's also some brand new, or relatively brand new, international guidance called the Voluntary Guidelines on the Responsible Governance of Tenure. This is really a food security-driven document, and it provides strong guidance on what best practices look like in terms of land. And it really is important and historic in important ways because it calls for recognition of customary rights to land, which are so important in Africa.
Which one overrides the other?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So in different places, you're going to get a different answer. In a lot of rural areas, customary law is going to be the law that most people follow. It's going to be the law that is most meaningful to local people. But in fact, if you looked at law books, the law books would say that it's the formal statutory law created by people sitting in a capital city that actually would trump the customary law. So you have this interesting situation in Africa where de facto, it's customary law that's most important to most people. In a formal sense, though, the statutory law should override the customary law, but it may not because, you know, governments don't necessarily reach out to rural areas, and they may not have as much legitimacy as local leaders who are implementing land laws for local people. So you really do have a system or a situation that many people refer to as legal pluralism, multiple legal systems operating at the same time.
Does it happen often that statutory law clashes with the customary law in regards to land?
Yeah, it does sometimes. I mean, the women's rights to land is one good example of that. In some countries, women have very strong statutory rights to property and to land. But in practice, out in communities, those rights may not be observed. They may not be enforced. Women may be subject to discriminatory actions like being thrown out of their homes if their husband dies or not being allocated land by customary authorities when they may have formal rights under the law to acquire access to land or to be given plots of land. So that's one of the areas where there is a pretty consistent difference between statutory law and customary law. Some countries are trying to deal with that, the gap between those two legal systems, and Kenya is a country that's trying to do that. Through the 2010 Constitution, Kenya has really made a strong effort to recognize women's rights to land and has worked to try to reach down to the county and to the traditional authority level to instill in traditional leaders the importance of recognizing women's rights to land, because women contribute, as you know, so much to agricultural production in Africa. And by protecting their rights to land, you increase their incentives
right.
to produce more and help their families and communities.
And why does it matter who controls the land?
Oh, it matters so much. I mean, land is power, right? Land is the primary asset for most people, especially in rural Africa. And who controls the land is the person who has the most power in a community. So if the government controls the land, it has a lot of power. It has power to protect people, but it also has power to move people off land, and that can lead to harms. If customary authorities have control over land, they may act as good stewards and guardians for their communities, but we know in some cases customary authorities are not really doing a good job of being stewards for their communities and are selling land to investors, for example, and to other people in communities. And if those traditional authorities aren't good stewards, then community members will suffer. If women don't control land, then they can suffer personally and their families can suffer. So who controls land matters an awful lot.
That is Carol Baudreau of Cloudburst Group here in Washington, D.C. We will get to talk to her later on in the show. But first, let's listen to what your opinion is on land issues in your country.
My name is Esther Mwambi. As a woman in Uganda, I'll give an example of my own family. Our father does not consider girls in terms of giving land. He only gives to boys. He says that the girls will get married and then will get land from the men will get married from. So it's not easy to inherit land. But it's easy to buy land as long as you have money. Yes, I have land and I acquired it by buying through my own savings. But the other problem with land issues in Uganda is grabbings, especially in the urban centers. If you buy land and you don't fence it off, or if you're not rich or recognized, they can easily grab it from you, richer people. So if you buy land, let's say in Kampala or even in other towns that are developing fast, you have to develop it quickly, like building or fencing it. And
I'm called Sime Bosco. I'm a Ugandan, though I'm living in South Sudan. Yeah, I do need a good land policy because it depends on how you got the land, and when a land is in a good policy, you know, it is safe, it is protected.
Welcome back. So studies show that lack of access to land, which essentially means that one will also lack access to economic opportunities, is one of the main reasons for rural-urban migration in Africa. And once the young people move to the cities, the problem does not end there. In fact, we see a lot of housing pressures cropping up. We also see informal settlements. We have an issue of street children and many other issues continuing to plague Africa's urban centers. Carol Baudreau advises that one of the ways to make government more responsive to the needs of young people around land issues is to have their voices heard more often when it comes to issues of land.
They absolutely should be concerned about who controls the land, and in an ideal situation, they would have a bigger voice in making decisions around how land is used and how land is allocated. I mean, the youth in Africa, youth can be, as you know, anyone from maybe 18 all the way up to 35. The time that they can marry, the time that they can start a family, really depends upon whether or not they have access, at least in rural areas, whether they have access to land, whether they have a home that's been built. So they may need to put off starting a family until they have access to land. They may not be able to grow businesses unless they have access to land. They may be in a position where their economic opportunities are really constrained unless the elders in the society and other members of society are kind of willing to work with them to say, okay, we know all of our community may be facing some constraints around land, but how can we work with youth to make sure that they have a voice in decision making? Because ultimately, they're the people who are going to be taking over responsibility for the land assets in the future. So getting them involved at an earlier stage can be really important. And again, that land is a critical asset for the, for youth, for the community as a whole. So we need to be thinking really carefully about how can youth be involved in decision making around land so that when they are the people who are controlling it, there are better opportunities for them, because we do have this really critical youth bulge that we're facing in Africa. So, you know, you need to be thinking about Absolutely. Where are you going to create jobs? How are you going to create economic opportunity?
Now, you've done extensive research on the continent and other parts of the world around these land issues. What kind of engagement have you seen between government engaging young people around land? Is that something that really they even talk about?
Yeah, it's not something that actually gets a whole lot of attention right now, and it's unfortunate because youth really can have, I think, a powerful impact on bringing new ideas to bear. Youth, in important ways, are very entrepreneurial. Sometimes it's because they have to be, but that the great energy and the entrepreneurship, the exposure to things like new technologies that youth have that older people may not have, could be a really valuable asset as you're thinking about how to do a better job of managing land, using land, and leveraging land to help improve economic opportunities in a community. I can give you one example. I was in Tanzania 2 months ago, working with a group of young people who are mapping the land in their community. This is through a USAID project called the Mobile Application to Secure Tenure Project. So working with young people who are using smartphones to map out the parcels for their community members. And one of the young folks who was doing this said, you know, now that I have more secure rights over my land because I've just mapped it and I've just registered my rights, I know that I'm going to be able to go out and invest in doing more sustainable farming. I'm not going to invest in the old ways of doing farming. I'm going to do it in a more sustainable way using irrigation, using better irrigation processes. I'm going to grow crops for market that restaurants and other folks can use. So I'm not just going to grow maize. I'm going to grow value-added products and do it in a good way so that my land will be useful for me over the long term, not just over the short term.
Are there incidences where land is actually owned by the community, not just individuals in the community?
Yeah, certainly. There are a lot of parts of Africa where the community still does have communal rights to land. They own land sort of jointly, the way in the U.S. maybe we might own a condominium. Lots of people have rights to a single piece of property. So that's actually pretty typical across Africa. There are some places where people do hold private rights or individualized rights to land, but in a lot of places, communities own those rights jointly. And in that case, it's almost never the case that the community can outright sell all of its land. It can lease its land to outsiders, but it usually can't sell the entire parcel.
Mm-hmm. So how do people originally acquire land?
Wow, it's really confusing, isn't it? You know, so in some places you acquire land because from your traditional leadership. The leader in your community might say, okay, if you, Jackson, you want a piece of land, you can go out to this area where there's still forest. If you clear the forest, you get the rights to the land that you've just cleared. And those rights will pass down to your children and your children's children. So that can be a pretty secure way of getting access to land. But, I mean, imagine then you've cleared the land and you're living on a particular property, but all of a sudden new people show up around the edges of your land. Those people might be there because there's been a civil war in the next country, or maybe they're there because they're climate refugees and they can't live along the coast anymore. They need to find a more secure place to live, and your property is where they end up. So an interesting question in Africa has always been, how do you deal with strangers? How do you deal with new people who come onto the land?
Now, recent studies have said that weak land rights in Africa are part of the reason why we have what has been termed as a land rush in Africa and elsewhere. Governments from Uganda to Ethiopia have been accused of selling off a lot of chunks of land, and they sell them to large corporations and developers, local but mostly foreign, which is also in itself another discussion and a bigger problem. And the fear is that this kind of land redistribution or sell-off could easily trigger widespread civil unrest. And activists and experts have always argued political leaders in these countries to recognize the customary rights of poor people who have lived or worked on these lands for centuries. Jeffrey Hatcher of the Rights and Resources Initiative explains.
The amount of land that is owned by customary communities around the world is about 3 billion hectares of land. And just to give you a sense, in sub-Saharan Africa, about 1.4 billion hectares of the land is not legally recognized to be owned by customary communities and under customary tenure rights systems. These are just the traditional rules and obligations that regulate ownership of land. In a lot of the developing world, it's basically a system of rules and laws that are known as customary laws because they're not written down in code and they're not in statute, basically. Customary law in the UK or in the United States is basically the basis of our legal system. And in Africa, the law of communities has as much weight to them as our customary law has to us. Large-scale timber companies move into Central Africa and sign commitments to build schools and produce jobs, and really the fact of the matter is they don't do much in that regard. They might produce some jobs at low-paying wages for people.
Welcome back. This is Upfront on the Voice of America. We are talking about land rights and land use, land ownership, land tenure systems in Africa as related to young people. But we should also say that the system of patriarchy that exists in many African countries, in many societies around Africa, has tended to be discriminative of women when it comes to ownership, to owning land or controlling the land resources in their communities. It is very necessary that we have laws or policies that redress this kind of gender imbalances when it comes to holding land or acquiring land. But is it harder right now for young women to acquire land as it was for their mothers or their grandmothers?
So Jamila, do women have access to land, the same type of access to land as men do?
I wouldn't say so, because sometimes, depending on which culture you're talking about, we have issues whereby sometimes, you know, say for Muslims, for example, they inherit land according to how the Sharia law affords them to. And then you have, like, say, an Igbo land where women don't particularly have the right to own anything. So it depends on what you're looking at. In terms of whether the Constitution of Nigeria allows women to own land, that is up for grabs, because the Constitution may say one thing, but then in reality, culture and religion tends to supersede, you know, what the government says.
So customary law it has precedence over the Constitution. Now, you cover a lot of northern Nigeria, and as you talked about, women in Islam specifically having access to land through inheritance. So a woman cannot inherit the same amount of land as a man.
So basically, say, for example, my brother and I, if my father has like two houses and it's between the two of us, my brother will own one house in like one quarter. So I get to own, for every house he owns, I only get 25% of it. So, but however, what they normally do in Islam is before having to go through inheritance, they'll gift it, especially to the female child. Mm. And that's normally a source of security.
And what is the implication of a woman owning land in these communities?
It's very important, Jackson, because what happens is if a woman doesn't own land, or because land is a good asset to have, it's a good investment to have, what they normally do is you use it to raise funds, emergency funds, because we all know, you know, sometimes things happen in life where you do need large amount of cash. The only thing that seems to sustain value in where we're from tends to be land and gold, of course. So it's a very important mechanism for people to realize. And I think it's especially for Muslims, whereby women and men are actually they inherit differently. Mm. I think it's something that needs to be considered for parents to safeguard their daughters.
Now, I've read of stories where women who have lost their husbands say that they have lost their land to land that they have inherited from their husbands. They have lost it to the husband's relatives. Are there any safeguards or type of security in the system, whether it's the traditional or the customary system? There's some sort of punitive measures towards people who come and grab the land, because this is an issue that is pervasive all over the continent.
Absolutely. The only safeguard measures that you will find is if the husband blatantly explains it, like there are even though paperwork, unfortunately, they don't really protect you against that. But, you know, with the witnesses, the problem that we're having is if the customary law actually is what's taking, you know, precedence over anything else, the husband really needs to make sure. And unfortunately, you don't find that a lot. The issues of this land issue, he'll tell you over and over that it is yours. You could have all the proof that you want, but if anything happens to him and you go to, you know, in front of the elders, they will still grab that. They'll say that you know it's not yours, regardless of whatever proof that you have.
Which laws do you feel should protect women ownership of land? Which one do you feel is stronger and that it can be enforced if it is abused or broken by people who are blatantly either grabbing land, as we said earlier, or who are not respecting some of these laws?
I actually think it should be constitutional law, because customary law seems to be, you know, it depends on the whims of whoever is executing it, and it changes from generation to generation. Mm. So in order for it to be relevant to now and, you know, where we are, and for it to actually be continuous, I think it should be constitutional. However, for Muslims, it does not matter what constitutional law says, Sharia still supersedes that, you know, constitutional law. So this is the reason why it's going to be different to actually say, oh, you could, you know, exercise what Sharia say, but then you can't exercise what customary laws.
Personally, do you own any piece of land in Nigeria where you're from?
I do.
And how did you acquire it?
I inherited it from my grandfather. So it's
And you visit the land?
Not as often, but it's a place where now I'm planning to build on it so that I could at least, you know, say, oh, I'm earning. Something.
Do you have any type of paperwork that shows that it is yours?
Yes, I do. You know, whenever they go to land, or, you know, when they go to people that are selling land there, it actually has our names.
Thank you very much for listening to Upfront on the Voice of America. I would like to thank my co-host Nadia Sam in Johannesburg, South Africa. We would also like to thank all our listeners who contributed to the show this time around. And if you have any questions or comments or want to contribute to the show in future, remember to send us an email at upfront@voanews.com. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, my handle is @UpfrontAfrica. Let's connect again next week, right here, same time. On behalf of my colleague Nadia Sami, my name is Jackson Vunganyi. Goodbye.